Welcome to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with your host, Tom the Digital Architect Liebel. Are you tired of spending money on marketing efforts that produce little or no results? Unable to decide whether internet marketing is right for your business? Want to take your brand to the next level but are unsure of what steps to take next? Hey, you're not alone. Join thousands of others in their pursuit of growing a profitable business and learning actionable strategies on how they can outperform brands that are older, bigger, and stronger.
Hey, listeners, welcome back. Today with me, I have Brian Eisenberg. He's a co-founder of Buyer Legends, an author of Be Like Amazon, an author of Call to Action, and an author of, I think there's like five or six other books.
Six books altogether, yep.
There you go. Hey, Brian.
How you doing?
Doing well, man. Tell me a little bit about Buyer Legends, first of all, and how that came about.
Let's play on the legends word first, because obviously that's where we're really playing. So, you know, when you think of the word legends, it actually has two connotations, right? It has that storytelling element of a story bigger than life. And the second connotation is that of a map, right? In other words, telling you kind of a guiding you of what the map means and where to go. And that's really what our process and our company helps people do, right? We want to use storytelling techniques to align sales, marketing, operation, customer service, product to the customer experience. And we do that through storytelling techniques and also by mapping out the legend of what's supposed to happen, where it's supposed to happen, and obviously also have it in a measurable way so that we can duplicate it and improve upon it.
What makes a good story?
Wow, that's a complicated question. I don't know if we have enough time for that, but first of all, I think we have to start with who our hero is. And unfortunately, when you look at a lot of companies' marketing, they really try to make their product the hero. And ultimately, you really have to focus in on making your customer the hero. And I think if you don't start there, you're definitely not going to end up with a good story no matter what.
How would you make a customer the hero? Can you give an example, maybe so that it's clear for the listeners?
Sure. I got to think of some great ones, but we were working with a company that recently that helps people who have financial issues, right? And instead of focusing in on what the products they have that they can, help them out of their challenges, the language and the story we tell through the website copy, through the videos and all of that is positioning them as if they're helping themselves and their family members out of this crisis.
Right.
Right. And the product is there to support them in doing that. But they're the heroes for taking the action, for doing the right research, And so you're really just looking at it. Part of it comes from one of my favorite quotes. If you've ever read The Everything Store, right, the unauthorized biography of Amazon, Jeff Bezos, there's a quote in there where he's having an argument with the – and this is another great example. He's having an argument with some of the publishers because he wanted to put up the reviews on Amazon. And, of course, we know how that story ended up, right? Where now I think it's something like over 50% of all products before they're purchased are, people read the reviews on Amazon before they buy it, right? And Jeff Bezos told publishers, no, you don't understand. We are not in the business of selling books. We are in the business of helping customers buy books.
Right.
Right. And that subtle shift of perspective of, hey, he's trying to help the customer do their research, accomplish their goals, right? They're the hero. They need to find what they need to get to. They need to get to, their end journey. And he's just not going to get in the way of them doing that.
You know, with all the problems that Amazon's having with fake reviews, just give me your opinion. Like, what should they do with that?
They are doing quite a bit, and it's at their scale, it's not an easy problem to solve, But they're really working hard at trying to get a lot of those verified purchases. They have their Vine reviewers as well. The last I heard, they're also putting in, some controls that if you haven't purchased, over a certain amount. So they're using different kind of signals to weed out what could be fake accounts for reviews. Again, it's not an easy problem to solve. It's not going to solve tomorrow, but it's still better than nothing.
Yeah, I agree. That last book you published, I think, is called Be Like Amazon, right? That's the last one?
Correct.
Yeah.
Yep.
And it basically says anyone can be like Amazon, even a lemonade stand. How so?
So interesting enough, today as we're speaking, it just got released. Be Like Amazon, even lemonade stand, just won the Axiom Business Book Award, the Bronze Award for Business Fable.
Well, congratulations!
Thank you. And the reason I say that more than anything is because what we wanted to do when we came out with this book, because this is a book we've been thinking about for several years, and originally we were gonna just dissect Amazon and so that people could study and understand it. And it's by having a number of conversations, people in and out of Amazon and watching what they've been doing over the years. And when we first started out in this industry in the early 90s and Amazon first launched, we watched them and of course we heard the press and we weren't the biggest fans. But over the years, I realized that, Jeff Bezos was doing something significantly different that I honestly, and my brother and I didn't understand. We didn't understand how they were able to build such a tribe of loyal followers and to see the kind of growth that they have. And they really rewritten the business operating manual. If you think about how, traditional management styles were for the last 20 years, I think we're going to start seeing that there's a new operating system in town and it's the way Amazon runs the business. And so what we decided to see is, these four pillars that we talk about Amazon's success. And of course, there's other pieces to it that we allude to in the book as well. But the four pillars are there other businesses, large and small, that leverage these same four pillars for their growth? And certainly, we saw everything from, local jewelers around the country to heating, vacuuming, and, air conditioning companies to companies like 1-800-GOT-JUNK. And they were all built their growth based on these same four pillars. And so any business can do it. It's just a new way of thinking and approaching business, right? You've got to start with this customer-centric point of view, which is, collecting data, using data to serve your customers. You've got to innovate on their behalf because business models are changing and their needs are changing and their desires are changing and how they're using products are changing. And then you need to be able to act on those innovations, right? Because it's not always so easy just to, anybody can come up with a brilliant idea, but if you can't actually execute on it, that's a real struggle. And I see a lot of companies over the years that I've worked with, that's definitely been their largest struggle. And that doesn't matter whether you're a startup or, a multinational. Execution is definitely a challenge for a lot of organizations. And then lastly, which is where I first started in the online marketing industry, which is that you have to optimize, right? And you have to optimize on, and it has to be part of the whole culture. Everybody's got to look for improvements from boardroom to stockroom on how you can, eliminate waste and improve the experience for the customer.
What would you say the biggest win could be for a company that just wants to apply one of the things that you teach?
Interestingly enough, the book before this one was the book we called Buyer Legends, and that's where the name of the company came from. And what happened is, my brother and I had started the first conversion rate optimization agency in 1998, and we spent years, helping, companies from, GE, Dell, Overstock, Google. I mean, you name the companies, tons of companies. We helped them improve their conversion rate. And when we left the agency and we really wanted to try to understand what was it that made a significant impact, and this was because of a project we were actually doing with Google, that they asked us to kind of go back and look at the processes that we were using, saying, okay, what is the key thing that made it work, and how can we make your process portable and agile for you know, for the type of company that we are. And so we went back and we started interviewing not only old clients, but people who used to work at the, you know, at the clients and who were part of the teams and may have not directly interfaced with us, but just trying to see what was that commonality that made, you know, they moved on, they may went somewhere else, and they took some of that information as a success. And the number one thing that came out of all of that was that everybody who had done it had basically used our style of personas, which are not what most people think of personas. We can talk about that separately. But they used the personas to tell the stories of their customers and, in how they were creating products and how they were launching marketing campaigns and how they were doing redesigns. And by taking that perspective of the customer and using those personas, it changed careers. And I think that's probably, you know, the number one most powerful.
Now you have to explain these personas. You set the ball up for yourself. I had to ask.
It's interesting because there was an article this past week about how personas are dead. On my good friend Jay Baer's blog. He didn't write it, but someone else did on the Convince and Convert blog. And we're actually getting ready to publish it. And I think it's because people use the term without just give it a blanket statement. Oh, personas, checkbox. Yeah, we use that. And they don't really take the time to understand, you know, there are user-centered design personas. There are buyer personas. There are the personas that Alan Cooper talked about in Inmates Are Running the Asylum, which he used for software design. And then there are the personas that we've been talking about since 2001, which really deal with buying modalities and buying preferences and information gathering preferences. And when you understand how people gather information, how they make their decisions, you can plan the content they use. You can plan the images you use. You can plan the the pace at which you try to sell them your product, right? Some people want to purchase things quickly and easily. Others want to take the time and research and become the experts. And you have to kind of understand that to really balance out, the experience properly for them. And so it's taking a much deeper dive into understanding and telling the story from these modalities, which is based on the human operating system. And using that to come up with these characters that, as one of the clients we worked with this past week, we did a 3-day workshop with them, said, you know, they become your imaginary friend. You know, you can talk to them, you can hear them. I hate to use the example of a fictional character because this is not a character from a movie. But could you imagine if I told you tomorrow night you were going to host Tony Soprano for dinner? Would you know what conversation to avoid?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I've seen the seasons.
Right? Or if I told you that, there was a, 40-something-year-old man who found a wallet in the middle of Manhattan, he was Jerry Seinfeld's friend, right, George, you might have a sense of the way he would act, right, and what he would do with that wallet, right, because we've gotten to know these characters. And we use those kinds of script-writing techniques to create characters so that everybody in the company can relate to who you were doing business with. It's not some abstract, customer 64321, right? It's a real person, a real entity that you can have empathy for. And so when you're approaching your tasks at work, you're really looking at it and your customer from an empathetic point of view.
Let's dig into that, because what you're talking about now is super interesting. How would you tell a company, like, what should they do to develop a really good profile on a buyer? Because, you know, there are different worksheets out there, and people say, do quizzes, but what is your, process of doing that?
Well, Well, so we go through a good amount of the process in a little bit in the Buyer Legends book and a lot more in Waiting for Your Cat to Bark. We actually go through it a lot, but that book is like 9 books in one, so it's a little tougher to get through. Luckily these last couple of books have only been like 120 pages. They've been a little bit more digestible for people. The first thing we do is. While I consider myself a marketer, we try to pull in as many people outside of marketing as possible into the process. All the people who have direct frontline contact with customers, right? And unfortunately, in most organizations, marketers actually rarely touch customers. They don't see customers use product. They don't answer service calls. They don't sell to them directly. So they don't really, really, really have a good feel for who their customers are. And one of the first methods that we use is we start creating, as an illustrative purpose for them to help. And this is really to help them understand that they have different types of personas and what they look like. And to simplify it some ways as well. I mean, I remember years and years ago, we were working with one of the large web conferencing companies, one of the original web conferencing companies. Let's just leave it that way. And they had done a persona exercise, and they had felt they had 46 different personas. And when we showed them what we call our schizograph, which is understanding sales complexity, we were able to show them that, in fact, those 46 segments that they had really boiled down to 5 or 6 different methods of buying, right? They were just different shades of gray. In other words, how many crayons do you have, right? They were just different shades. And so that helped clarify them. And what we do is, we start this schizograph, and we create a scale from 1 to 5, and it's a 2x2 grid, right? All consultants live on 2x2 grids, and it goes from 1 to 5, 1 on the inside part, and 5 going to the outside. And we map it based on, okay, what's the need for the product? What's the risk associated with the product? What's the knowledge associated with buying the product? And what's the consensus needed to buy the product? And this happened to us because people basically started asking us, well, what's a complex sale? And all the definitions out there said a complex sale is a sale that's complex. And we realized it made up these 4 dimensions: need, risk, knowledge, and consensus. And we mapped those out. And when you start realizing, there is definitely some people who need no consensus. They can just make decisions on their own. And then there's someone who they need to get their spouse involved, or they need to get their family member involved. Because, buying a pen for a business does not need a lot of consensus. Correct. In most businesses, unless you're NASA, right, and you're spending $6 million on a pen. But planning a extended family vacation could need a tremendous amount of consensus. That's a complex sale. Right. And so you have to understand those dimensions. Once we get the team understanding, okay, the shape of the purchase looks different and there's a few different ones. Now let's go to describe what they look like, describe the buyers a little bit more. And so, again, we go to another 2x2 scale, and we go to and this comes back to a little bit of understanding type and temperament, where we're looking at objectivity and decision-making preference and speed of decision-making preference, whether they're more deliberate or they're, quicker to reach decisions. And so now we're going to start mapping the characteristics of the persona. And so what we ask the team to do is go and put together, and what we love doing post-it notes for this, and we'll ask people who have the contact with their customers to write adjectives that describe their customers. And people will go ahead and they're like, okay, they're cautious, they're deliberate, they're excitable. And they start taking all of these and say, okay, as they start writing different members of the team, we say, okay, start putting it up on the post-it boards in these 4 quadrants. And then we start doing it. And then we'll take all of these different notes and we'll make sure that one, they're in the right quadrant, because sometimes they don't get in the right quadrants. We'll take the duplicates and we'll match them together. And then we start clustering them together. And when you start putting the clusters together, you start saying, oh, this person who's, you know, excitable is not the same person maybe who's this deliberate. So that's already showing us we may have two different personas and how they approach decision making. And when you start doing that and you start laying around parts of the story and other techniques that we use to create what we call the character diamond, you now have the beginnings of a strong persona. And of course, you know, after that, we'll go ahead and we'll layer it on with, you know, research that we have, you know, research that you can get from, you know, audience segmentations. So, and really create these people who are just, like I said, they feel like imaginary friends. You just absolutely know who they are.
Once you build one of these, how would you tailor the story to them? Because obviously the website would probably be already made, or the marketing materials. So now you have to change things to actually talk to that customer.
You are so right. So it really depends on the process, right? Because sometimes we're coming in there and people are asking us, you know, help us plan, you know, the marketing automation, or, you know, help us plan, you know, the website redesign. And so in those cases, it's much easier. But the first thing we have people do, and we just finished this workshop, a 3-day workshop with one of the clients this past week, and they are planning both sides, right? What they realized with understanding that when they dug deep into their personas is what, that they really didn't serve all their personas in the right way. They weren't giving them the products they needed in the way they wanted it. And so they're actually probably going to launch maybe one or maybe two new websites based on understanding the needs of the different personas that they can serve. But the first thing we did after we had the initial round of the personas is we take different team members and we ask them to really read through the narrative that we wrote up about these personas, really to kind of get into character, almost like a play, right? And to play these personas. And we'll actually have them go ahead and do searches just like this persona will, or stumble across advertising like this persona will. Maybe, you know, they see a Facebook ad or an Instagram ad, whatever it is, right? And then go through the journey of the website and find, like, oh, you just asked me that. I'm not ready to answer that. I'm gone. And they can, and the whole team is watching this, and you know, and this other teammate is now that persona that we just created, and they're looking at him like, I can't believe we would do that, and we just didn't understand. And they find all kinds of new opportunities. Just as a simple one, we were working with this client this week, and they never asked, and I mean they've been in this business for years, and it was shocking as they went through the process of doing the personas. Several of their personas actually became couples, right? There were couples involved in the decision making process. That was the consensus part. Right, it wasn't just one person making decision; it was the couple doing the decision together. So, what ended up happening is they realized that they actually never, in their whole process of both their content and sign up forms and everything, never asked whether there was a spouse involved.
That's interesting.
And none of their competitors do either, by the way. But it's such a significant factor in the purchase decision that, like, they should all be taken to the barn and shot, and that's being kind. I'm just kind of joking. But it's like, these are marketers. They deal with these people all the time, and they all miss this very – I mean, it's like, that's the question that will change their business this year alone because they went through the process, right? And it'll change one or two little things to the immediate site based on the fact that they're able to navigate it from that persona's perspective.
You know, I'll share something with you, and this is a scary fact about marketers that I've learned. I worked as a sales guy for a lot of big corporations when I was younger.
Yep.
And I was introduced to some of these marketing guys from our company. Mm-hmm. You know, these assholes, they never left the corporate world. They mm-hmm. never spoken to customers. they would ask us a couple questions, but not even ask us. They would just kind of want to, assumptions, yeah, I just want to get confirmations. And we'd be like, bullshit, none of this would work. And they're like, oh, okay, okay, yeah. And they would go lock themselves back in their little office and just do all these marketing things. And, you know, the worst thing was, you know, they would give us these marketing materials. And we would create our own because their shit was just not working. It was horrible. And then they would get all up in the, you know, in everyone's business, like, what are you doing? And you just got to go through a legal department. I'm like, guys, just let us sell. You know, and one time we took one of these marketing guys with us on a sales call, actually on a full day. I remember it was a full day.
Yeah,
but,
yeah.
Yeah, but he was with me on a sales call. He couldn't sell shit.
No.
He had no idea what these people wanted. And this guy's making marketing materials for us.
We see that all the time. But it also happens in large companies where the product people never use the product. Never watched customers use the product, right? And yet they're leading the product roadmap. This happens all the time. This is all part of the silos that exist in organizations that break things down. The reason Amazon is so successful, ultimately, is that this new operating system that Jeff Bezos created for running companies and at scale, and you notice he's done it in retail, he's done it in services, he's done it in media, he's done it in, I mean, you know, he's, whatever business he picks, he's just going to do it. And all he does, there was a great article in NPR not that long ago that talked about how he revived the Washington Post. And if you read it, there's the four pillars. That's it. And what he does is he creates small, independent teams. They're all frontline people. They all have responsibility for everything. You know, no team larger than two pies of pizza can feed. Okay, and everyone has the tools and resources to get to the data, take actions. They don't standardize on any technology, so they're not limited by technology. If they need a solution for why and it's not internal, they'll find a way to get it. And then eventually, if they need to build it out, they'll build it out further in-house. Because, of course, there is resources. But they think and act like a startup every day. And, you know, a couple of years ago, I was part of another startup team, you know, kind of as an in-between thing. You know, we were speaking to customers daily, right? Because if we weren't, we would never have gotten the right product. And I don't get how large – I feel bad, and I get it. You know, in some organizations, they're structured – in a way that companies have been structured for the last about 100 years. And so they're really put out of touch of the customers. And so one of the things that we actually even do with some of the companies that we consult with, and today we really try not to work with so many big corporate clients, you know, like the Googles of the world anymore, but we're really focusing on more owner-operated companies. People can really make decisions. And so, like, we're really even helping them change the way they do job descriptions. Every job description, I don't care whether you're in IT or whether you're in janitorial or, you're in finance. Every job description is written from the point of view of how you serve the customer.
Okay, you got to spend on that.
Well, because if you truly want to create a customer-centric organization, everybody's got to understand how their role impacts the customer. And so for the janitor, as an example, right, his job is to maintain an environment where our customers feel at home and comfortable and that they're well taken care of.
How does that
sound different than, okay, you're going to mop the floors, clean the toilets, but it changes their perception of what they're doing. And it's like, oh, okay. You know, they have a purpose to serve, you know, accounts receivable, right? Their job is to, you know, collect the funds so we can keep financing new products for our customers. And it's just how you phrase things changes people's perspective.
You know, this makes a lot of sense.
You being in sales will totally understand that.
Yeah, I mean, it makes a lot of sense because, you know, when I sold things, like I would have to hand in my orders to another department, right? And they were so detached. I think they were super confused who they were working for because they would treat me, the sales guy, like shit. They would treat the customer as just a nuisance if they, you know, it was a really weird thing. It was like they're trying to please the boss.
Yep. They were just trying to do their job description. That's it. And they didn't really understand that at the end of the day, the number one boss is your customer. The funny thing is, Sam Walton is, and we talk about that very early on in the book. Sam Walton always said that, you know, the customer is boss. Procter & Gamble said the exact same thing, in the CEO speeches, and that they can fire you at any time, right? Especially once you start losing your way. And unfortunately, this happens to a lot of companies, and we're gonna see. You know, a lot of companies struggle to stay around because these new rules that are being rewritten outside of their own industry. It's not even their own competitors, because as we see, you know, Amazon's now talking about going into health insurance. And I mean, it was not more than about 3 years ago I spoke at a health insurance conference, and I asked the audience. I said, "What would you do if Amazon was going into your business tomorrow? How would you act differently?" Okay, and I got to tell you that I have not seen any of those companies that I've kept in touch with since then act much like Amazon. And now Amazon's going to enter their business with, you know, I don't know if you saw the news with J.P. Morgan Chase and Warren Buffett, and they're going to change the healthcare industry.
I did see that news. I seen that they're entering the FedEx and UPS space also.
Yep. I mean, how many of us hate that process, hate the cost? I mean, there's a lot of flaws in that model, and they're going to go ahead and they're going to find a way to hold on 1 sec. Okay, sorry about that.
Okay,
yeah, they're gonna find a way to make that model more customer efficient. And it's not that UPS and FedEx aren't doing some innovations and trying. But they're innovating more from a product point of view and less from a customer-centered point of view.
You know, it's very hard to imagine what the shipping industry and the healthcare industry will look like if they actually care about the customer.
Well, it's funny. One of my big predictions is that over the next few years, and I think it's Jeff Bezos is probably waiting until Tesla finishes fighting the battles for the direct sales model of cars and getting rid of all the franchises. I don't think he wants to go into that battle, or doesn't need to go into that battle. He figures there's already someone competent fighting it. But my prediction is over the next few years, he will purchase a transportation company, cars, trucks, airplanes, right? It could be something like a Mercedes Benz, something like that. And basically, and we're starting to see some car companies change models. But what's going to happen is just the same way that he points fingers at an industry and all of a sudden the stocks drop, okay? The way he acquired a Whole Foods, I believe he'll eventually acquire a transportation company because that's their business, right? That's a big part of their business.
That's true.
And they will disrupt the car owning business, because here's what we know already. For most people, owning a car, for the number of time and hours they spend in the car, doesn't justify owning a car.
No.
Right, based on what you spent for parking, gas, insurance, the lease, and I mean, I have a number of friends around the country who've gone and they just started doing, you know, Lyft and Uber and things like Car2Go and a couple other things, depending on where they live, and the numbers for them make way more sense than you know, leasing or owning their own car. Okay. What would a model under Amazon look like that's totally customer centric? So you basically lease the car from Amazon. You get charged by the usage of, let's say I needed to drive me to my office. When you're done driving to your office, it's now that vehicle is now being used for deliveries, endpoint deliveries and within certain neighborhoods. Then when you need it back for your end of day, it's back to go back home. And then in the evening, it's being used for something else.
Yeah, it's interesting, right? The only thing I would kind of counter you know, if an emergency happens, right, and the car is being used by something else, well, I need a car right now.
So, I'm 99% sure they would account for that.
Yeah, I bet they are. I'm just saying that's like the only thing I can think of that I would counter.
So you plan for those extremes to say, okay, your vehicle's not available, but they're going to have countless number of vehicles available all over the place, and they'll just basically send you that latest one. I mean, and I think, you know, when you realize that, you know, 98% of the time your car sits idle.
Yeah, that's true. It's true. That's why I completely agree with most of that. Yeah, like,
yeah, the model doesn't make sense. And it's like, the other thing is, you know, just think about parking spaces. I mean, you know, where I live here in Austin, you know, I've got a seven car driveway here, and you know, on a cul-de-sac. So I'm not worried about parking my car. But you know, I grew up and spent most of my life in Brooklyn, and you know, I know you spent some time there. So you know, alternate side of the street parking, like that's a nightmare. Could you imagine if just it's the autonomous car just driving around delivering stuff while they're cleaning my streets? Okay, no problem.
You know, I've spent so many hours circling the block trying to find parking in Brooklyn. You just brought back the worst memories. Like,
is that the? I'm sorry about that, but yeah, I mean, what part of Brooklyn were you in?
I was in Greenpoint.
Oh, in Greenpoint, yeah. I mean, I remember, you know, so I lived in Sheepshead Bay, but we had offices in Red Hook, and we had offices in right near Park Slope as well, and so. You start thinking about these things. We were in Dumbo, and you know how people used to have to double and triple park.
it's true. I mean, it was so bad too, and they would walk with those parking tickets and just hand them off like it's nothing. Like, oh, 3 meters from the, you know, it was so bad, man. Like, just it was incredible.
But that's why. But it's, you know, both from an environmental and from a consumer point of view, owning cars is just a bad business.
But then, you know, you mentioned Austin, which Austin, from what I understand, is not walkable, right? So there is
depends where you are. Yeah, no, depends on where you are.
Yeah.
But the distances are far. So you need a car. But you know what? I know I have friends who live in downtown Austin that all they use is a combination of Uber, Lyft, and Car2Go, and they spend a fraction of what I do a year, and they put on more mileage than I do.
Wow. You know, I'm actually heading to Austin pretty soon. And, you know, I know some listeners are too, because there's a couple conferences going on. What is the...
South by is coming up any day now.
Yeah, I was going to say, give me like two or three best places to eat in Austin. I know people always ask this.
Yeah, well, here, I'm going to give you the first hack that you need to do. Okay, the first hack. Sign up for Car2Go. Okay, depending on what city you are in, you know, around the country, Car2Go, and one of the best things about the Car2Go is you can actually drive it to right outside the convention center and drop the car off. So you can pick it up at different parts of the city and then drop it off. And then in the evenings when you're ready to go home, if you just walk west away from downtown, right, a little northwest, you will always find a Car2Go free and you can get to your hotel with no problem. I've been using that hack for years, and so now just your listeners will know about it. But it's because oftentimes you'll get crazy surge pricing in South by for Ubers and Lyfts.
Right.
But the Car2Go's are always the same price, and yeah, they're you know, you've got Mercedes Benz and some other cars that you can drive, and it's beautiful.
Wow.
Anyway.
Okay. I'm with you.
You know, there are lots of places. So you know, I'm a vegetarian for one, so I'll put that aside. But of course, there are amazing barbecue places, and you know, things are going to get nuts. Lots of great fusion places in Austin. You know, Asian fusion, a bunch of others. Some real interesting kind of categories there. But I always like to tell people like some of the healthier stuff. Juice Land is one of those places you never want to miss.
Okay.
I drink the juices and smoothies, and I've basically had them all across the world and all across the country, and I have a very hard time finding a place that has a better overall menu, both from taste and a nutrition point of view, than Juiceland. And they already have something like 20-something stores here in Austin, Dallas, Houston, and Brooklyn, of all places.
Oh, wow.
So they're a great place. Lick Ice Cream.
Lick Ice Cream. I like that.
Lick Ice Cream is a must do. And then if you have to go for the taco debate, I'm a big fan of Torchy's Tacos in town. Breakfast tacos are a must, but Torchy's are absolutely just my favorite in general. I think they have a same kind of thing, right? They do some very interesting combinations of taste and flavors, and there is a secret menu. So make sure you find that as well. You can find it online. But definitely hit a Torchy's. There are so many incredible places. It's probably already too late, but if you're a fan of sushi, you definitely want to get try to see if you can get a reservation at Uchi or Uchiko, the two great places, Michelin star type places. There's no shortage of good food here.
Yeah, that's what I'm hearing. Sushi I actually get right in Japan whenever I go. But the tacos, I'm always on the lookout for tacos. And I hear Austin is just out of this world.
Wait. So, but even on the Uchiko. So this this is one of the interesting things. So, Tyson Cole, who's the chef, has actually. So long story. One of my friends, who's who I'm an advisor to his startup here in town, knew Tyson back from college. And so Tyson got the basic story from what I understand is got kicked out of his house of his girlfriend because he didn't have a job. He finally went to found a place working in a Japanese restaurant, and the guy let him wash dishes. Eventually, he got him to the point where he let him chop vegetables and then start making rice. Then he shipped him off to Japan to study how to make sushi with his brother.
Okay.
And then brought that back and created Uchi, which is Michelin award winning.
So
it's not your traditional sushi. It's really, like, it's worth looking at the menu. Just go look. I think you'll find that one fascinating on its own.
Very cool. Can you tell me from last year, what are some of the best books that you've read?
So I like to listen to a huge variety of books. And I mix mediums. I go everything from Kindle, hardcover, Audible. It really doesn't matter. I am, I basically take advantage of whenever I have time. I'm going to try to figure out where I do it. So some of my favorite books, I'll give you some of the ones I just finished. Do You Talk Funny by my friend David Nihil. Great book, just about how to add comedy especially into your business presentations, whether you're doing a sales pitch or anything like that. Comedy works. It disarms people. It's a great approach to doing things. I'm just finishing up a presentation I'm doing at the end of this month, and I have calculated in there right now at least a laugh every 4 minutes.
Nice.
Right. And so really kind of what you kind of aim for. I loved Chip and Dan Heath's new book, The Power of Moments. Peter Shankman's book, Faster Than Normal. While I don't necessarily have ADHD, I certainly have some elements of it. Obviously with kids, I'm very fascinated around what's going on with that. I think he did a great job with it. And I loved his audiobook because if you've ever heard Peter speak.
Good fan of Peter, and I actually worked on with him on the website and the podcast.
Okay, so the book alone was definitely one of my favorites from this year. Perennial Seller, Ryan Holiday. I thought that was a very gutsy book. It was a little bit counterculture. It kind of told you, everybody's a – and it's funny because I have a friend in one of my groups who just did some huge AI research and he scanned bios, and everybody's claiming to be a best-selling author. And, of course, there's a very big difference between being a New York Times or a Wall Street Journal best-selling author and a best-selling author, right?
Right.
Because people create a category at Amazon for an hour – they blast it and they become a best-selling author. It's not quite the same thing. But his book really is the premise of how you have to build something that has sustainable power. Why they keep selling year after year after year, like Michael Gerber's The E-Myth. Right, that actually has been selling more and more every year since it's been published.
Right.
So real interesting from that perspective. My friend Phil Jones has come up with a couple of really good books. The couple sales books. Mark Schaefer's Known book was one of my favorites this past year. I think that's that gives you a good sense. And then of course, my son is also a up and coming baseball player. He's a very dedicated 12-year-old, and what I mean dedicated, he's in the gym four days a week. And other days he's in the batting cages and pitching and stuff like that. And he's a little bit of a monster boy at 12 years old. He's 5'10" and about 190 pounds.
Oh wow.
Yeah, size 13 feet. I mean, he's a like broad-shouldered, big boy. And so I actually just finished listening to a golf-related book, which we listened to together, basically to help him understand how and I think it's a good book for anybody, called Be a Player. And it really is just a fascinating approach about understanding your breathing or your tempo and your environment and how to really pay attention to those things.
Interesting. Brian, where can people find you?
BuyerLegends.com, BrianEisenberg.com. Of course, I am, on Facebook, on LinkedIn, Twitter, Instagram. I'm not hard to find.
Awesome. Thank you for coming on.
It was my pleasure.
Thanks for listening to the Smart Brand Marketing Podcast with Tom, the Digital Architect, Liebelt. For more tips, tricks, and interviews, come visit smartbrandmarketing.com. That's smartbrandmarketing.com. And join the newsletter. It's free.